Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Matthew Christopher, creator of the Abandon America book series, website, and the podcast you're listening to. Thanks for listening, and I hope you're enjoying it so far. If you are, and you'd like to support the podcast and help keep it going, there are three things you can do that'll really help out. The first is simple. Just tell your friends and family about it, or leave a positive review on your podcast platform if they support it. Good word of mouth makes a huge difference. Second, if you'd like to hear early episodes and see exclusive essays and photos that aren't on my website yet, you can become a patron at patreon.com/abandonamerica. That's patreon.com/abandonamerica. Third, if you'd like to advertise on the podcast, just drop me a note at admin@abandonamerica.org. That's admin@abandonamerica.org. Every little bit counts, and I've got some really exciting episodes that I think you'll love coming up. Don't forget, you can also visit my website, abandonamerica.us, for tons of photo galleries and background info on hundreds of abandoned sites, or order my two Abandoned America books from your favorite retailer. Hi folks, this is Matthew Christopher, and I do not feel in any way ready for Season 2 of the Abandoned America podcast to start. I probably never will, but if my work's about anything, it's about how sometimes you just have to walk straight into the thing that makes you afraid and see what happens. The past few months since the end of Season 1 in May have been pretty eventful for us. We bought a home and moved again, and we're currently up by Catskill, New York, which is pretty wild considering if you listen to Season 1, we did two episodes on the region before I had any idea we'd be moving here. Moving on to this season, I have some really great interviews lined up. We'll talk with an author of a new book on the rise and fall of malls in America, a young man who joined a community effort to save an abandoned church, one of the stars of the only television show about urban exploration ever, the senior vice president of an abandoned prison that became one of Philadelphia's hottest tourist attractions, and a whole lot more. I'll have new episodes for you every 2 weeks with some amazing stories about abandoned places and how they got to be that way. Today, we're going to start things off by interviewing Norma Ryan, the former mayor and a lifelong resident of Brownsville, Pennsylvania. Brownsville has gained a bit of a reputation as a ghost town. People still live there, but up until fairly recently, one man owned dozens, if not hundreds, of properties and left them to rot, including an abandoned hospital, a hotel, a train station, banks, apartments, churches, and homes. The story behind it is one of the most unique and strange things I've ever heard in my travels, and Norma knows it better than anyone. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. I'm Matthew Christopher, and you're listening to Abandoned America. Hi, Norma. I am so happy to have you with me here today and really excited that you're going to be able to share some of your story. Also, tell us a little bit about Brownsville, which I think is one of the most interesting places that I've been to. Basically, I think maybe in the beginning, the best thing to do is if you can tell us a little bit about yourself and what Brownsville was like when you were growing up.
Okay, Matthew, as we said, my name's Norma Marcolini Ryan. I was born in 1931. Right here in Brownsville to Italian immigrant parents and grew up in a We Love America home kind of atmosphere. And it was really neat growing up here and moving on with life, you know, married, having three children and moving on. But my little growing up period in life here was so special, Matthew, because I grew up during the industrial era, and that was the busiest time for Brownsville. It's when we had the highest population. It was the coal mining, the railroading, the boat building, and the interesting part that I always love to bring up is that I remember as a child walking downtown, my two brothers and my parents, and the streets were, the sidewalks were just lined with people. I mean, they were just filled with people, and store after store after store was just filled with people shopping. And it was such an exciting time to grow up in during that era. And our population was like 10,000 people. So, you know, it was really busy. And it was a fun time to grow up in Brownsville. And I just have absolutely wonderful memories of that era.
If we're looking at the background of the town, I mean, it has a really sort of long and varied history going back to the 1700s, right? So maybe you could tell us a little bit about the beginning of that and move it up to when you were born and what things were like then.
I love that. Yes, our history does go back to the 1700s when they claimed that this area was known as Redstone Old Fort, and it was hunting grounds for the Native Americans. And the first immigrants that came to Brownsville in the 1700s were the English, Irish, and German immigrants. And they brought with them their talents, and they began developing the town. One of the first industries they started was boat building. And it was just, you know, I just can't even fathom what it was like in those days, but we're just so grateful that they did start the town like that, because as time moved on, and in 1809, when Thomas Jefferson passed legislature to open a road between the East and the West for the westward expansion, Brownsville already had a little business town there. So those pioneers coming in their Conestoga wagons didn't have to bring all their wares over the mountains in their Conestoga wagon. They could purchase in Brownsville and travel west on the road if they chose, or they had a choice in Brownsville because of boat building. They could buy a boat on the Monongahela River, flowed north to Pittsburgh, to the Ohio River, to the Mississippi, and points west. So that was what we call our westward expansion era. And it was pretty prosperous and pretty interesting at that point. And it lasted until the railroad came. And the railroad was a blessing in many ways, because wares could be transferred west much easier. It brought a lot of employment. So the blessing of the railroad in 1850 brought its good, but it also put the town into a decline. And it went into a decline for quite a few years until late 1800s, early 1900s, when coal was discovered. The vein of coal in this area, southwestern Pennsylvania, was the Klondike. There's the Upper Klondike and the Lower Klondike. Upper Klondike had the best coal, the cleanest coal that made the best steel that we always say made Pittsburgh the steel capital of the world. Our Lower Klondike coal was very good, but not quite as pure and clean as the Upper Klondike. But in this, our little region, coal mines were popping up everywhere. And as they were growing, and in the coal mine little patch town, some of them had company stores, some didn't. While that was happening, our population was growing in Brownsville because many immigrants came in to work in the coal mines, the railroads, the boat building. We also had a great Jewish population come in that opened up the businesses. Our downtown during that, and we call that the industrial era, our downtown was just filled with stores. And it was just a very interesting, and that's the era I grew up in. And one of my memories that I love to share is that I recall as a young person coming downtown with my parents and brothers in the town being so crowded that we had to walk out sometimes out on the street to get back on the sidewalk if we wanted to go into a particular store. And when I would tell that story to our interns, because later I was very involved with Brownsville Area Revitalization Corporation, and I would tell that story to our interns and AmeriCorps young people that we were working with, and they would just sort of roll their eyes and think, you know, what is she talking about? Until a little later, and they started interviewing people in the town and came back to me and said, everyone says that. And I says, well, that's because it was true. That is how crowded the town was in the industrial era.
I think that's really interesting because, I mean, you know, I wouldn't roll my eyes about it, but it certainly wasn't what I saw when I came to the town. I mean, when I came to Brownsville first in 2008, what I saw was really sort of an abandoned main street with a large, it looked like, would say, seven-story train building. Is it seven or eight stories?
Five. It's five.
Oh, five. It seemed bigger in my heart.
It does.
So there's that building right there. There were hotels, there were banks, and it's just this main street of buildings that were all closed. And it's hard to imagine the town being that prosperous, but at one point we went to the library and they had a video that was shot in that period. And I mean, not that I think that you would pull my leg or anything, but you're right. When you look at it, it's sort of night and day to see how bustling it was and how many people were there versus the current condition when I was there. Going back a little bit, you were saying there was kind of one period where there was a boom and then it petered out at the end of the 1800s. And then there's a second boom as coal is found. Why did that boom bust? Like, what happened there that led to the town kind of declining again in the post-war period?
And you're right, Matthew. When you came in 2008, it was abandoned downtown. And the decline of our industrial era is, I think, multiple. One of the things was, you know, it's after the war. There's not as much coal needed, not as much steel needed. Additionally, that was the era of beginning malls. Starting in 1950, our decline began and it kept declining and declining, and multiple things were happening. So as people were moving out of the area and the downtown was no longer prosperous, the stores were closing, the buildings were closing, and the town was closing up. That, you know, I think all led to our decline of the industrial era, which was the largest era in our history of our town. Our population at that time was 10,000. We're today about 2,000. So that real boom time of the industrial era is the greatest time we had, when employment, people, activities. We had three movie theaters in town. We had skating rings. We had bowling alleys. I mean, there was everything you would want for a prosperous little town. Everything, when their decline came, then stores closed, businesses closed, activities closed. And we sit back and say, okay, so what next? And I think we're still in that little, what next? What's our next era? And in my mind, I want to say our next era is going to be the tourism industry.
Well, I want to get to that and the revitalization efforts. But before we do that, let's first talk about this sort of 1-2 punch of the decline of coal, the malls that are taking people away from the downtown. There's already this slump happening. At this point, I remember when we first met and I brought up the Liggetts, you said to me, I charge people a dollar every time they bring up that name, but I will let you get by with it this time. I thought that was really cute. Let's talk about the Liggetts for a second. They kind of came in after this period where the town was already in a bit of decline. What was their role in that? I mean, basically, they bought up a lot of the buildings, right? Why did they do that?
Well, some of that is truly a mystery, Matthew, to know exactly what it was they wanted. I do recall when they came to town, and, you know, as we mentioned, the people were moving out, the stores were vacant, buildings were abandoned. They were starting to buy up these buildings. And when they first came to us, I was sitting on city council at the time, and most of us thought, wow. I mean, he had beautiful drawings and nice ideas, and we all were excited about it. And I think, you know, the beginning, it was exciting until we got to the place where nothing was happening. It was always the ideas, the plans, but nothing was truly happening. And I think that started putting a little discouragement into the people. You know, the supporters wanted to say, you know, what's going on here?
His idea was riverboat gambling, right?
Not all riverboat gambling. That was a part of it. But he also had ideas to have a trail along the river. It was to build up the downtown and to have outdoor recreation in the downtown. And one of the parts that it was to have boat slips on the river. To know truly what their ultimate goal was and riverboat gambling was one of the things. It sort of is a mystery to know what happened. I know one person said that they felt that their investors walked out on them. Who knows? That still is a mystery to this day to know what was their real intention. Why didn't it happen? And it just left a bad taste in our downtown because, you know, by that time they owned most of the buildings in the downtown.
The story, at least as I was told, was that Ernest Liggett was a salesperson, right? And that he had married somebody who had a fair amount of money, and he had this very ambitious sort of dream that he was going to, again, turn Brownsville into like riverboat gambling. He was going to buy up all the buildings and really revitalize the area. And then that never really materialized. And at first, people were really over the moon about him and thought that he was kind of like a savior of the town. But as time wore on, he went to completely the opposite end. Would you say that's true? I mean, did people kind of go from thinking, wow, this guy's really going to fix everything up around here, to as he bought buildings and wasn't delivering on the promises, thinking, what is he doing? What did people think about him at that point?
That's when I think the decline started. I mean, you know, the support, because in the beginning, I believe he had a tremendous amount of support in Brownsville. Because as I said, his drawings were beautiful, his ideas were beautiful, his plans, but when nothing was happening, then the people began to say, hey, what's this all about? So his support was diminishing. And whatever happened on the other end is something we none of us really know. It just all of a sudden, he's out of there and we're left with him owning the buildings and nothing. Happening.
One of the things then that was brought up to me was that, for example, in the train building, that he was raising rents on people and kicking people out of offices and things like that, because he was expecting that he was going to be able to charge much more when things kind of boomed around him. Is that correct?
My understanding is from a few people that were in the Union Station building that yes, he did. He just changed the locks and they were out of there. And as he was losing that support, it was like no one else knew what was going on. Why would you close the Union Station building? Why did you abandon all these businesses and had to go search somewhere else? And that's why I said that's those kind of mysteries we don't know. And it's so hard. It's very, very difficult to understand what was the ultimate goal behind all this. I don't know.
Yeah, that's kind of the big question mark. And I think one of the things that really makes this story so unique is that there's a lot of boom and bust cycles in towns. But the thing that's really odd here and that you can't wrap your head around is, first of all, where would you even get all the money to do this, but purchase all these buildings kind of on the cheap and then let them fall apart? Like how many buildings and what types of buildings did he buy?
Oh my gosh, he owned every building in the downtown and throughout the community. I don't remember the exact amount now, but it's a tremendous amount of buildings that he owned. And he bought up all the good buildings downtown, all the business houses, because, you know, they were all ready for to be sold because people had moved out and were willing to sell them at a nominal amount. So what his true investment was, I don't know. And that idea, did he have other investors? If he did, that was not made public. So it is interesting, as you're saying, did he walk in there with that kind of money in his account so that he could buy all these? I don't know. To this day, I don't know. And I don't know that we'll ever know the answers to those questions.
What happened then with the buildings? Essentially, he just left them vacant.
That is correct. Well, when I was the mayor, we brought Governor Rendell to town. And when Governor Rendell saw what was happening to our town, he was quite upset also. He was very generous and he awarded a grant for $2 million to the county, to the Redevelopment Authority of Fayette County, to take the properties by eminent domain and to stabilize. So the county does own the buildings now. The county was able to take the entire downtown properties by eminent domain. And I know that wasn't easy. That had to be quite a chore. The disappointment I felt is that the stabilization of putting, just, you know, encapsulating the roofs or doing something to that effect didn't happen, and the buildings continued to deteriorate.
You're touching on something that I had as a question earlier, and I think this is a little bit better of a point to get into it. You were mayor of the town, right? And what period were you mayor of the town in?
I was the mayor of the town from 2000 to completion of 2004. And prior to that, I sat on city council. And of course, I was the very first female mayor. Town was founded in 1815, and I was the very first mayor. So it was a little different for the community. But for me, I believe it was a great experience. I met so many people. I lost the election. The next I ran again, you know, at the end of my term, and I lost that by 10 votes. But the experience was worth it. It was just a wonderful 4 years of my life that I just met a lot of wonderful people. And I learned a lot. It was such a growing experience.
I think that's a really amazing accomplishment, because kind of how you've put it, there was a little bit of resistance in some quarters to having a female mayor even then. You also said there was kind of a wild story about how that came to be.
Yes, I'd like to share that with you. As I said, I sat on council, and it was pretty challenging at that point because, you know, it was a very male-dominant community at that point. And I thought, I'll never run for office again. But my friends tried to convince me to run for mayor. And I thought, well, all right, give it a whirl. You know, my children, who were all living in Florida at the time, said, you know, Mom, you're better off. Let us put up your money so you don't have to answer to anybody. Okay. So they did. So I'm a registered Democrat. And when the primary election came along, the Democrat that was sponsored by the party won the election and I didn't. But what I didn't know is that my friends wrote me in on the Republican ticket, which put me on the ticket. So in general election, here I am as a Democrat running on a Republican ticket, and I won the election. That, you know, is always humorous to my family, saying, oh my goodness, only Brownsville could that happen. But you know, it just, I think we have a lot of bipartisan people in our community. We're out for the good of the community more so than following the party lines, as that proves, because I had no clue that anyone was even writing me in. So that gave me my really great experience.
Oh, that's wonderful. Just for sort of frame of reference on this, what was the period where Earl Liggett was buying up the buildings?
That period was, I would say that had to be sort of the late 1990s when, you know, because yeah, I was on council when he came to talk to the council people about he wanted to have some plans. So he was probably buying them up from you know, the late 1990s. Yeah, there was just a lot, you know, going on in the town at that time. And it was, you know, there was that high hope. And there were some skeptics, but as a rule, I think that most of the town was excited to think, wow, something could be happening here. It didn't. And we just have to move on and say, okay, what's next for us?
So at the point when you were mayor, the buildings had already been bought. Would you say at that point it was already an issue where people are like, what are you doing with
them? Well, at that point, he was still presenting plans.
Oh.
I still think he had some followings. He still had some followings in that period, you know, because he would come up. And I have to say the plans and the ideas that he came up with were beautiful. And so he would hold meetings and, you know, and ask people, support this. What do you think about that? And so there were some support. It was just as things were not happening. I think it's in that era and shortly after after I was not mayor any longer, I think people were then beginning to say, what is going on? What's happening? And I think that's, he was beginning to really lose that, you know, that support. Well, of course, I'm sure, wait a minute, I back that up. I don't think he was showing any reports at that time, Matthew, I take that back. It had to be before that he was, because it was during that period that people were really getting concerned about the vacant buildings, nothing happening. And then that's when we felt grateful that Rendell came in and helped us.
I saw the plans that he had, and you're right. I mean, they looked terrific. They really did. And certainly they looked like he had a really solid idea for rebuilding the town and kind of bringing life back into the community and everything. Why were the buildings in limbo for so long after that? He has these plans for the town. He doesn't follow through on them. Why did the buildings just kind of sit there after that? Was there an effort made to reclaim them or anything?
Well, he was owning the properties and obviously had been paying a little taxes, or they would have been put up for tax resale. So that's my assumption, that even though he was not doing anything, you know, the buildings were still in his name, unless there was a reason to repossess that building. Even if it's lack of taxes, I think, you know, it has to be more than 1 year that, you know, the taxes. So that, in my opinion, is why things sat in limbo. that long because the process, he's not doing anything. No one saw him any longer. And it is sad, but that's the way things happen. And so eminent domain was the only way you could take those properties.
A lot of times people will ask when they see places that are abandoned, well, why doesn't somebody do things about it? And I think that's, you know, what you're talking about is exactly that, but it's kind of an answer for it, because you can't just walk in and say, all right, you haven't repaired your roof for a while, this is ours now. That's not how personal property works.
No, you're right. Yeah, it is a process. It takes a while. And even the eminent domain took time. Even though $2 million came in, it still took the county a length of time that they could take the properties, because you have to go through so many steps and processes, which I don't know all of the procedures of that, but I know it did take a while until the buildings became ownership of the county.
Were the buildings in relatively good condition when he got them?
Yes, because, you know, it hadn't been that many years that everybody had moved out and et cetera. So had he maintained them, I think it would have been a lot easier, but just allowing the buildings to set there from, you know, the 1990s, sitting there 10 years or so with nothing happening, you know, that buildings will deteriorate.
Sure, so, absolutely. And I'm sure that must have been really frustrating for you and for a lot of other people, sort of feeling like you're being held hostage.
Exactly. The whole town, it just was, yeah, there were just a lot of animosity and unhappiness about it. But we've had to make ourselves move on. We said, yep, that happened. It was not a pleasant time, but we move on. And what's our next steps to do? Because, you know, as we said, the town, it is a quite interesting town. And we were known as Redstone Old Fort until 1815, when two brothers, Thomas and Basil Brown, bought a plot of land, lotted it off, sold them. And then they formed this community named after them. That's how we got the name Brownsville. Because prior to that, or we would have been Redstone Old Fort to this day, but today we're known as Brownsville. And that goes back to 1814 when they did that. So yeah, there's just that so much history in the town. It has to be told. That's the story we just have to spend on some time telling.
Can you tell us a little bit about Brownsville General Hospital? My understanding is that originally that was primarily for the miners, then later became a retirement home.
A nursing home, yes. Well, in 1965, they built a new hospital right out of town a little bit. And when they built the new hospital, which was much larger because they needed more space, I think the old hospital was only 100 room and the new one is much larger. When they did, at that point, they sold it and it became a nursing home. And then from the nursing home, it became abandoned. We not only had the hospital there, but we had the nurses' school right next to it. There were two huge buildings right there. And when they became abandoned for the, you know, after the nursing home is when they needed some attention. And of course, you know, they didn't get the attention they needed. And so they went into a decline and, it's really sad. I know you've asked me before about, you know, the preservation and so forth of our properties that I've always felt extremely sad about. My children, as I mentioned, live in Florida, and in Winter Park, Florida, was a very historic community. And what they did when the town went into a decline, they practically gutted the insides, but they maintained the outside walls. And I know in Brownsville, and this is jumping a story here a bit, but when we were starting our Brownsville Area Revitalization Corporation, and we had an opportunity, the Flatiron Building being donated to BARC, we had to have a structural engineer come. And he said, these buildings will never fall down. They're 5 bricks thick, 25 inch thick foundations, stone foundations. He said, they'll never fall down. So I guess that mentality in my brain thinks, was that how the hospital was built? Because as I mentioned, if in Florida, they could save those buildings and let new construction inside. But when you're walking along, you think you're in an old town and you walk in and oops, ultra modern inside. That was what my dream was to do for Brownsville. You know, it didn't happen. So that was my thoughts with the hospital. I was just hoping and praying that they would do something, even make apartments up there, because it was such a well-built, large building. But that didn't happen. It was demolished, and so was the nurses.
Regarding its closure, I mean, in its last days, it was the Golden Age Retirement Home, I believe, right?
Golden age nursing home.
Nursing home, yeah. And there was a expose on it, actually. It was like kind of the center of like this precedent-setting legal battle because of the allegations of lack of privacy, neglect, poor care that was provided. And the whole legal case was kind of like there were a bunch of people in the community that were basically trying to get it held accountable. And then there was a lawsuit that was brought against them for collusion. And the precedent that was set there was that if people are trying to work together to get somebody held accountable for like code violations, that doesn't count as something where people can be sued for it. Do you remember anything about that period?
Well, there was so much negativity during that period. I mean, so much negativity and so many groups disagreeing with one another, etc., that it's hard to tell. You know, sometimes in a small town, it's sometimes very difficult to know what is small town talk and what is the truth. But yes, there was some lawsuits. There were lawsuits. And that's, I think, what ended up in the building being permanently closed.
We have the hospital building closed. We have a number of other buildings in the downtown and sort of sprinkled throughout the community. After all of these closures, the area really became a popular spot for photographers and people like me. You know, I remember, I would say it was 2008 when I first came to the community. And after that, I remember the point where it really blew up on the internet and everybody was going there. Everybody was sneaking into the hospital, which is kind of funny because that was one of the most dangerous buildings I think I have ever seen. I mean, the floor was so bad in there, and there were sections where entire chunks of the second floor had collapsed into the first floor and then into the basement.
Wow.
There were areas where the walls weren't supported by anything. They're just hanging there on goodwill, basically. And so I really was kind of shocked, actually, that nobody had got hurt there. But I also, I'm interested in the feelings towards people going into those buildings. How does the town react to that? I've heard different stories from different people. One woman, for example, was telling me about how that's totally fine. And she was glad that people were interested in the community. But I think neighbors to the hospital didn't have that feeling, for example. How would you describe that? I mean, what's it like when people are coming to your area and sneaking into these abandoned buildings? What would you say people felt about that?
Well, I think the greatest fear, just as you mentioned, is for people getting hurt. I understand the curiosity of photographers, and some of the photos that I saw on the internet were, I mean, I was even shocked when I saw some of the inside hospital with all the furniture still there. I was amazed that was, you know, still sitting in there and some really nice gems. I understand that. But the point is, like you said, what if someone got hurt? I mean, that was the greatest fear of mine when I saw, especially young people, running around with their cameras, it frightened me that they would get hurt. What if the floor collapses? You know, what if the ceiling falls in on them? That's the part that I think concerned me as well as many people in the community. But then again, on the other hand, I mean, there were many photographers. We saw them all over town all the time. But this one in particular, I call him our little gem. He came into town to take pictures. He ended up buying one of the box buildings that really was in need of a lot of work, had some broken pipes, etc. So he bought that building. Outside, was from Philadelphia, outside investor, bought it, rehabbed it with these private funds, and currently has an antique shop in the bottom floor and an apartment uplift, eventually moved into. He additionally invested in an abandoned house that was part of a movie shot in Brownsville called Maria's Lovers. He invested private monies in that, and it is currently an Airbnb that is occupied 70 to 80% of the time. So, you know, there you say, we can't say we don't want photographers in our town. We love photographers because you're taking pictures of our town. We don't want you to be hurt. And that's, you know, but they're out of saying, if we didn't want photographers, we wouldn't have had this happen. And that's a big plus in our town. They have a website called Maria Lover's House. You can make reservations to come there and stay. It's an adorable house. They have done an outstanding job on that house. And then people that come there, I know they'll come up to our museums and visit and buy lots of things in our gift shops. So it has brought people to town.
I think that's really cool. I've met him, and I'll put a link to the Airbnb in the notes for this show so people can go and check it out if they want to. First of all, he's a super, super nice guy. And second of all, the house is amazing. It looks like a movie set. When you look at it, you think, oh my gosh, this should be in a movie. One of the stories that I had, the one time when I came to the town, I was really interested in the train station. I really wanted to see what was in the train station. And so I was walking around in the railroad tracks behind that, looking at the building and thinking about how I might get in or whatever. And there was a gentleman who walked into one of the doors in the back of the building. And I was like, oh, okay, I need to go talk to him. So my friend who I was with and I, we went over, and he was very friendly. And at this point, I didn't know any of the history of the town. He invited us if we wanted to have any food or lunch there. And he said that he had food that was donated for people that were financially struggling or homeless. And we were sort of like, oh, we don't want to take food for people that actually need it. But he said, well, you know, I get more than I can use, so it's just going to rot anyway. So, you know, just to, you know, sort of be polite, I think we had a cookie or two, and we're sitting there talking to him in this store. And you can... I'm not a superstitious person or anything, but you can feel the whole rest of the building around you. You can feel that this is a light on in an otherwise very dark building. And so he told me the story about the Liggetts, which again, at that point, I really didn't know. And he told me about how Ernest's wife, Marilyn, was very religious and that he was a salesperson and that he had essentially used her money to buy up buildings in the town. And he had all these plans for them. Kind of what we were talking about earlier, the tide had changed when his plans fell through and that he sort of became a recluse. Nobody really talked to him or anything. And then he was telling me a bit about his own history and how that dovetailed with it. And I thought that was really fascinating. So basically what he had said was that, you know, he had grown up in the town and he left for a while. And when he came back, he was really kind of saddened by just seeing the area not as vibrant as it had been and you know, realizing that the town was kind of in need. So he had a dream, he said, where God spoke to him and he told him that he was to open a secondhand store and that anything that people needed, if it was food, if it was clothes, if they couldn't pay for it, he would just give it to them freely. That was part of the mandate. And so after he had this dream and he had this sort of purpose, it was sort of like, well, how am I going to do that? I mean, it's great that I had this vision of opening this store, but like, I don't have any money to do that. I don't have a place to do it. According to his story, at one point he was driving down the main street at night and a spotlight from the hotel building turned on as he was doing it. And it was right on where the thrift store was. He just had this very strong sense that it was a sign that he was meant to open his thrift store in that place. He got in touch with the Liggett somehow. It was somebody that he knew them or something like that. But basically, like, he wound up being able to talk to them. And as he was telling them about, you know, how he had this vision that was what God wanted him to do, well, Mrs. Liggett was very religious. So she said, essentially, okay, here's the keys for this store. Wow. And he went in. The thing that I thought was fairly interesting about this was, you know, there's some people that'll tell you stories like that. And they're like, well, yeah, I mean, that happens all the time. You know, a spotlight turning on and God telling you to open store, that's normal. And even he seemed aware and struck by how strange it was. And he said the strangest part was that he was talking to somebody afterwards. He was telling them about the spotlight going on in the hotel. And they were like, there's no spotlight that's working on the hotel. And he looked and lo and behold, there's no spotlight on the hotel. I mean, I'm pragmatic about things. Like, if you tell me a story like that, I'm not going to just be like, okay, that's, you know, it seems improbable, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But here I am in the store, in the building. And clearly that's what happened to some extent or another. Anyway, after that, we talked to him and like I said, it just had a very pleasant conversation and then went out and the side door was open on the train station. And so we went into the train station and went up to the top of the building. Again, bear in mind, this is like the first time I've heard all these stories. We found ourselves in the top floor and where Liggett's offices had been. And there's like this steamboat model that he has on his desk. We went into the room and it wasn't in anywhere near as bad a condition as it was later on. But going into the offices where there's still like the big table with the placards for, I think it was Casey, and various lawmakers that you could tell he had them there. There were still all the drawings and blueprints and architectural schematics. And it was like, wow, this is ground zero right here. I mean, it was, I would say, more than many places that I've gone to. There are a lot of places that have a presence to them, but being in there after hearing all of that and having that experience in the store, it kind of gave me chills to look at all of this stuff and be like, wow, I mean, this is really where that dream died. And he had this kind of ambition for it. And at one point, there was, I don't know if I should mention this or not, but I will, because why not? There was one room where on one of the desks, there was a book of photos. They were historical photos of the steamboats and the town in the early 1900s and everything. And part of the roof was collapsing on it. Like, there was all this plaster and paint and it was getting warped. And I was thinking, like, I normally am religious about not touching, not moving, leaving things where they are. But I was looking at this book of photos and I was like, this is going to get destroyed. And these are original historical photos of the town. So I took them out with me. And I mean, I had those for years. And to be honest with you, I mean, I thought they were cool, but I didn't take them for me. Like, I didn't want them to own them. I just didn't want them to get destroyed. And so when I met you at the Flatiron Building, you have this sort of historical society there. It's like, oh, okay, this is where they were meant to go. This is why I took them out. And certainly going up into that building in later years, I mean, it was just in such poor condition that I really think they would have been destroyed. Sorry for the long story on that, but that was one of the things that kind of happened when I was there that just really, like, all around a very kind of haunting story and something that really gave me a sense of the reality of things, you know. Know that sometimes when you hear stories like this, it's easy to think of them as abstract. You've talked about the mystery with Liggett and everything about, like, what exactly happened? Why did he buy all these buildings and it didn't work out? But I mean, it was clear that he had put a fair amount of effort into trying to make it happen.
Matthew, I had not heard that story about the gentleman, how he came about having that. I remember he had that little store in there that he was helping anyone in need. I never heard the original story of, you know, the light and et cetera. And that all brings me to mind is, you know, they do the ghost tours at the castle. And I can't say yes or no, because I don't know. There's things I don't know. All I do know is that Bark owned a building that we've had in renovations. And one of the construction workers asked me if the building was haunted. And I said, not that I know, because I didn't heard of the building ever being haunted. I did tell them that some of the people in the neighborhood told me they heard a phone ringing in that house. And I just sort of poo-pooed it and think, you know, okay, it had to come from the service station, had to come from somewhere else. How could it come from an abandoned house? So the next time I go up to talk to the construction workers, they said, we want you to listen to something. They were having their lunch and they said they heard the phone ringing in the building, and they taped it on their phone so that I could hear it. And so they wanted to tell me that they absolutely did hear that. So those things, like him saying that light, those things do happen.
I'm not really superstitious or into ghost hunting or anything like that. However, the experience that I had meeting that guy in the store, if it seems like one of those things where, like, I could have come out afterwards, told you about the story, and you could have been like, that gentleman died in the 1980s, and, you know, 20 years before you were there. It just had that feeling of, like, not being in a quite real place. Putting a pin on where we're at now, a lot of things are changing, right? We have quite a few buildings that were abandoned, that were torn down, as you mentioned, the hospital, some of the properties on Main Street. And unfortunately, like, a lot of the buildings were in condition where the whole interior was rotted. So they're not being saved. And you talk a little bit about that being a sad thing, but where is the town now? Like, what are people doing? How is it moving on after this period?
You know, I did mention in 1989 is when the nonprofit started in Brownsville called Brownsville Area Revitalization Corporation. I think they're a 501c3. They've done quite a few projects in Brownsville. You know, they've been able to acquire buildings to, with foundation monies, renovate them, and currently sell off, bring new businesses into town. They've worked hard since 1989. What really gave our town the jumpstart, in my opinion, is in, I think it was 2017, the students at the high school started a project called Students in Action. Two seniors, two juniors, two sophomores got together. These young people, and there's something called the Jefferson Awards. They worked in that. I had not heard of that prior to these young people, but they won award for their area in our region. Then they went on to win the award in the Pittsburgh region, you know, the expanded region of Jefferson Awards, for an idea they had to build a stage in our downtown. Because one of the young fellows that was in the group imitates Frank Sinatra. And every time we had an event downtown, we had to rent a stage. And he said, why don't we build a stage? So these kids put their heads together. They were able to raise $400,000 and built a stage in our downtown Brownsville.
That is
now,
amazing.
That is amazing. And it seems like when young people do something, they really, I think more people jumped on the wagon, because if young people are interested, how can you turn your back on that? And those young people have gone on to do wonderful things. I absolutely, in my heart of hearts, believe when that stage went up, we were asked to invite this developer into the town. And he was able to repurpose one of the historic buildings and add on to it to build 24 apartments for affordable living for seniors. And they're all full. It's totally occupied. I think that happened because I think he saw the vision of what these young people did. They went on additionally to put an addition onto our library as a teen room for, you know, computer use for those that don't have good computer use in their area. These young people have done a lot. But in addition to the development there, and then I told you about the man from Philadelphia came in and invested money. And then recently, someone in the last couple of years from out west, an investor bought the former bank building and is having 45 apartments in it. We have a local businessman who opened a restaurant. We have a bake shop came in. As I mentioned, the antique shop. We have just recently someone opened a sandwich shop in town. We have a new business that came in, a little boutique. So there is interest. It's coming slowly. The big thing that, you know, BART just had a strategic assessment done. We have a former resident, Mr. Klein, who invested in BART to have the strategic plan done. And one of the things there is, how can we bring about more togetherness in our community? And we've talked a lot about tourism. We've talked about bringing people to the town now. They can come and stay in a B&B. And BART is in process of making the Rose Mansion into a B&B also, which that will be housing for like all the apartments and people that live in our downtown. If they want family and friends to come, we want some overnight housing for them also. So I see a light at the end of the tunnel. You know, we've had our heydays of the westward expansion, the industrial era. I want to see this be the tourism era. And let's make this a tourism town, because there's so much history here. As I've mentioned, you know, first cast iron bridge in America, you can't see it anywhere else. We have six individually listed buildings on the National Register. We have a church built in 1865 that has been in continuous use since then, built by Irish stonemasons, all hand-hewn stone. We do tours of it. There are so many historic places in Brownsville. The Historical Society now is in process of, they have a home, they're going to turn it into a museum to be able to display artifacts of our town. BART in the Flatiron Building has three archival rooms of beautiful display items to show. We need to, in my opinion, capitalize on that rich history we have. I do feel that's, you know, as we said, every town has a story to tell. Let's tell our story.
The Flatiron Building, for the people that aren't familiar with it, it does look like a little mini Flatiron Building right on Main Street.
We have the museum that tells a story. We call it the Heritage Center. It tells the story of Brownsville in there. It tells you from beginning to end, you know, how we started out in the 1700s and where we are today. We've added an art museum. It's the only art museum in Fayette County. Frank L. Malaga was a local person and a self-taught artist, and his art focuses a lot on coal mining because his father was a coal miner. It also has so much art about local communities and industries, and it's just a beautiful art museum. I encourage people, come and see it.
I would say in the period of time since when I first came in 2008, and the last time I think I was there was 2019 at the end of the year, I have seen so much change, and it's been positive change. You know, on one hand, the hospital getting torn down is kind of sad, but setting aside my personal feelings of the preservation of the buildings, just in terms of the living experience for the community, it seems like things are really on an upward trend now, and that there's a lot more going on. There are more people that are kind of being active in the community. There are businesses that are reopening.
Yeah, there's a lot of activities coming up. BARC has done the Ducky Race, which is they dump 1,000 ducks in the river from our intercounty bridge. The river flows north and they come up to the wharf. Then they pull the first, you know, duck, second duck. And we have quite a few prizes. It's all donations from the businesses in the area. There's lots of prizes to win. It's so much fun to just watch the ducks coming in and say, whoops, which number has won? Is that your number? It's a real fun thing to do. And the other new thing that's happening this year is going to be the first year. We have a group that's going to have a river fest. I think we have some really great things happening, and it's very exciting. That's why I can't leave the town. I love it here and plan to stay here. Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to mention? If you had one thing to tell people who are unfamiliar with the area or something that you'd like them to take away from this story, what would it be?
I'm one that always feels open to hear ideas. I mean, you never know when some little idea is going to come. I know when I've served in public office, so often you hear somebody say, you know what you should do? You know what you should do? We have a gentleman that lives part-time in Florida, part-time in Brownsville. And when he came back home and noticed that the town needed a little cleaning up, and he didn't say, you know what you should do? He started it. He started a little group, and they now have cleanup days. They plant flowers. The town has come alive. And so I'm always willing to hear what are some other ideas, not what we should do, but what can we all do together? And anybody that wants to donate, every one of our nonprofits would be thrilled to death to take. We have a former resident of Brownsville, lives in California, and he's the one that paid for our strategic plan. He's also helping us now to hire a grant writer, and Ray's been just really good to us. So anyone else out there that has their love for town or looking to develop, we still have some buildings that could stand some redevelopment. The Union Station building, as you mentioned, is a gem that's waiting for somebody to come and do something there. And I realize it's expensive, costs have gone up. We also have a hotel that, in my opinion, I would love to see come back to life, because there too, with many people living in town, somebody, we want to bring people to town. We need this nice hotel. We've got two historic banks that are absolutely gorgeous. When you look at the architecture on there, and as I've mentioned before, preservation to me is more than just saving the building. It is also honoring our immigrants who built them. When you think the talent and the ability they put into the architecture of some of these buildings, it's, to me, we owe it to them to save these buildings. We owe it to them to say, thank you. You look what you gave to America, and we're so grateful to live in America. So that's sort of how I feel with preservation. It's more than just saving the building. It's honoring those who built it, which is, there's so much with a big mansion on Water Street that was a restaurant, and it's currently closed, but you know, that's waiting for somebody to come on, bring life to it again too. So we have an old Baptist church that's been abandoned for a long time. So we have a lot that needs life. So yes, anybody that wants to invest, we welcome you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to hear what you said about preservation, honoring the people that came before us, because that's something I feel very strongly about too.
Oh, absolutely.
history is us keeping the people before us from sliding into oblivion. And the agreement or the hope is that the people down the road will keep us and honor us. Norma, thank you so much. I think this is such an interesting story and I really appreciate you sharing it with everybody. And I'm going to put links into the show notes for Bark, Maria's Lover House, and things like that. So if people want to come to the area, they can check it out.
You can put my email address to Matthew if you want, if anybody wants that I can connect them to whomever they need to be connected with.
Yes, I will absolutely do that. All right. Well, thank you so much. And I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, Matthew. And same to you. It's been a pleasure. Fun, always fun time talking about Brownsville. It was a wonderful time. Have a great day.
You too. Well, that wraps it up for our first episode. Thanks for listening, and be sure to check back with us for our next show, which will be up in 2 weeks, where we interview a Philadelphia teacher who worked with his community to try and save a beautiful abandoned church, and we'll find out why sometimes even a strong grassroots effort to save a building isn't enough. In the meanwhile, check out the Abandoned America website, abandonedamerica.us, for show notes, photos of Brownsville, and much more. Or follow me on social media by looking up Abandoned America on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Also, if you enjoy the show, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/abandonedamerica. That's patreon.com/abandonedamerica. You'll get new ad-free episodes of the show and website galleries first. Vote on which places I cover, receive special promotions and giveaways, and there's tons of other content. I'm Matthew Christopher. Thanks for listening to the Abandoned America podcast.